You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Lily Hibbard. Lily, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thank you, Brainerd.
Let's talk about I want to talk about the shows that are coming up for you so soon, but perhaps we should talk a little bit first about the residency that led up to it, because I think that was quite a unique residency. And if I'm understanding correctly, you were one of the first artists to get that kind of residency. So could you tell me a little bit about the residency and how it led to these shows?
Yep. Well, it began with the first time I went to the Musée des Arts et Métiers, which is in Paris, was in 2008. And immediately I thought this is an incredible institution, replete with just the most magnificent collection and the spaces themselves, one of which is an ancient chapel dating back to the 14th century, probably earlier, who knows, in France. And so I decided that, well, after a few years of really basing some works on their collection as points of inspiration, I took about a year and a half to find a way in the back door, so to speak, because the museum had never really... They have artists that they invite to work with them, but they'd never had an official artist-in-residence.
So explain that to me a little bit more, because essentially you had to convince them to do this.
Yeah,
right?
A little bit. Hopefully they're not listening to this.
After the
event, they've said, oh, no, that was our idea. But it was thanks to one of the curators who's in charge of the Foucault Pendulum, which you've all heard of, I'm sure, of which the original is actually held, the original ball, because there's no original wire or anything, although they do have some wires in the collection, is in the storage of the museum, Musée des Arts et Métiers. So through quite a long adventure, I eventually managed to meet Thierry Lalande, who's the in charge of that collection and the pendulum. And he and I immediately struck up a friendship and just spent about a year conversing and meeting. And I wasn't living in France at the time. I was living in Australia. You can tell by my accent where I'm from. So I was coming twice or three times a year to work with a small commercial gallery and I had a couple of residencies with foundations. So I was coming back and forward from France. And Thierry eventually, he was like my detective. So he would sniff around and steal photocopies from the other curators' printing process and found out that they were doing an exhibition on Measures of Time, or planning one, and said, well, this is perfect for your work. It's like really spot on your interests. And, you know, I think it's important to have an artist come and work with us, contemporary artist. And so he said, look, why don't you put together a folio and I'll see if I can organize a meeting with the director. And that was in 2000, and so it's kind of, it was a two-way affair, because I didn't have the residency until after there was a sort of some idea of doing an exhibition was first tabled. And then, so that happened, and after 6 months, took a very long time, they said, okay, we're interested, we'll talk to you about being part of our exhibition on Measures of Time, of which, in fact, there are none, as it turns out. There's no such thing. When you consult, you know, experts in the field of measures of, you know, the hour and quantum physics, they actually say, well, no, that doesn't exist. So that's another story. So the long and the short of it, they ended up cancelling that exhibition. But in the meantime, they said to me, look, come and do a residency to develop your work for that exhibition. So I went back to Australia, being what they call la crise in France. There was no finance. So I went back to Australia and passed the hat around and raised enough to come back and do this self, basically, organized residency. So then I began that in the middle of 2014, June or July, and spent a solid 6 months in their archives and consulting mainly Thierry, but other curators. And then I also began working at the Observatoire de Paris, where there's a very long kind of connection between those two institutions and basically a crossover of their objects and research. So it made sense.
And what exactly were you doing there? Can you tell me?
At the Observatoire or the Musée des Arts et Métiers?
Well, both, because both of these were building towards shows, so I kind of want to know, for the listeners,
so
like, what is it that you were making?
Actually, when I just, about a month before I took up the residency, they cancelled the show. So that was always good. And then, but they turned around and said, oh, well, do your residency and see what happens. And I went, that's actually fine by me because I'd rather have a solo show. The show was cancelled and it was on a theme of Measures of Time, which, as I said, is actually a bit spurious. And I feared being set amongst a sequence of clocks. So, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
Something very kind of literal. And so I was given some independence and they left me alone. And basically what I did in this time is just started to consult people across the board of quantum physicists, experimental optical physicists, historians of photography, daguerreotypists. So I spent that first six months really just going over every single item that I could look at to sort of gather a broad spectrum of the collection. And I ended up narrowing in on a theme of light and this spurious Measures of Time, or just time itself, and sort of drew a line through the collection or picked. It was actually interesting that I ended up going back to Léon Foucault, who invented the pendulum, and it was really his work, three major pieces in their collection that of Léon Foucault that really became my focus. And so I developed this three-part exhibition based on those three works, which...
And can you tell me a little bit about the pendulum? Because I know of it, but hey, it's always been a little bit of an enigma. I don't totally understand it, although I do in a sense. But...
What's amazing, it's a pleasure to describe, but it's even more pleasurable to see. And the reason it has to be seen is because, in fact, it's a physical... Like you, when you're in its presence, you see in real time and space the gravitational rotation of the Earth. So how it works is that the ball is swinging and it's actually going in a looped passage. So it goes around, depending where on the Earth it's positioned, it will go make a full circle in somewhere between zero and 24 hours. No, it can be longer than 24 hours. In Paris, it's 33 hours to go right round. So in the so what's actually happening when you stand there and look at this pendulum that's swinging is at first you just see it swinging, but it very gradually appears to turn through, go through a cycle, and what they do so that you can actually visualize it in some museums, but particularly at the Musée des Arts Images, they place these little metal rods, which the pendulum progressively knocks over as it goes through its passage back and forward. And what's in reality happening is that it's not the ball that's going through a rotation, it's us. We're on the Earth, and it's rotating in the position that we're in.
Yeah, it's just a fantastic idea. I think I saw that there's one in the Smithsonian Institution in D.C. in the States, and that's where I saw it as a kid, and I remember then thinking, this seems incredible, but almost unbelievable. It's. I mean, I get it now, and I guess I got it then, but... It still seems kind of almost defies understanding, but I do understand.
Well, this is the thing about Foucault. I mean, he was actually outside the Academy of France till a few years before his death. He was an outsider in a sense. He wasn't overlooked in his time, but he certainly wasn't embraced, you know, either. And, I really perceive him from the point of, you know, in hindsight, given the luxury of time, as an artist in a way, because he... If you take that example of the pendulum, his capacity to bring into form, it's a very artistic way, it's a kind of jargonistic way of saying, he could realize the invisible, you know, make something intangible, incomprehensible in a sense, into a physical reality, you know, that you could see, touch, or... And he did this, there was a whole, you know, list of things he invented that, and the three that I chose to work with, inventions I chose to work with it particularly, so good examples of this talent he had, you know, to imagine, you know. So it's actually, for me, we're doing a lot of public programming, and one of the, particularly with school groups, because that's one of the remit of major kind of missions of the museum is to engage with schools and students. So one of the topics we're going to be presenting or discussion is on the imagination of the scientist, you know, that it's not just a matter of they already know the answer, but...
Right. It's an immensely creative field. I just read a biography of Tesla, and it's just extraordinary the kind of creative genius he had, but also a sense of something being elegant and beautiful, you know?
They do. Physicists talk about beauty all the time, or science, and mathematicians as well, you know, in their numbers. And to me, it looks beautiful on a page, you know, a formula. I don't understand the beauty within, which is what they're talking about. And there's definitely that profundity is so present in this pendulum, you know, that it's not, it's got an external formal beauty, but it's being itself, you know, ontologically it's beautiful, what it is, you know, how it functions in the world. And so, I mean, that's actually that's in the museum, and it's right in the middle of the chapel, the église, they like to call it, where the exhibition is going to be held. So
you mean the pendulum is right in the middle of that chapel?
It's right in the middle.
Wow.
And so I've actually, so the exhibition being called First Light, which I retained the English title, French don't mind too much, because it's got a dual meaning of in first light of the day, the origins of light, and in kind of terms of cosmological origins. And so the exhibition actually uses a quite specific scenography of light itself. So I've commissioned a lighting specialist to illuminate the pendulum. And so as it swings, it will pass through three or four focused LED lights, which will basically, as it hits the centre of its passage, will light up from different directions the pendulum. So that'll be a bit of theatre.
Sounds wonderful. And that is why, essentially, you pursued this particular residency. It was because of that pendulum in this space, correct?
Well, that and, you know, a long list of other things. They also have in their collection one of the first, what they call étalons, mètre étalons. These are the first metric measures, which, you know, of course, in Europe it applies, the metric system. But this whole, I mean, really, when you think about Western civilization, the invention of, you know, tools, let's say, or instruments to determine space and time, and in order to calculate, not only calculate, but regulate society, the birth of these things and these ideas, you know, are really just on the cusp of the first French Revolution. And so these objects for me don't only, you know, they're not just pieces of sticks or buckets, but they contain within themselves a history of ideas. And so, in fact, in 2011, I made a version of that mètre étalon, and in a sculpture, a bronze sculpture, which I exhibited in another show here in Paris in 2011, which was cast made out of a random, let's say, piece of wood that I found in the garden, which happened to have all these scored lines at an even equidistant scored lines, but it was entirely rotten. So, and I use this as a way to kind of describe, well, in fact, measures themselves never remain the same. I mean, you can place something in a systematically in order, but you can't actually, time itself you can't measure. It's always changing. So these are kind of arbitrary. They're so precise. Things have become so precise now that everyone, if you need to talk to any physicist, and they say, well, you're just, you know, being silly, you know, it's just so now become measured to such a degree that, you know, there's no point talking about the margin of error. But I like that margin of error, because actually it reminds us of change, you know, that there isn't, that we have to embrace change and not fix everything. So, I mean, this is a bit more of I've taken a kind of metaphysical turn, or much more philosophical turn on what for most people would be a very sort of strictly scientific history and sociological history. But for me, that opens up a whole way to think about. And one of the second, and I'll talk through, I guess, the three parts of the exhibition in a moment, one of the other major kind of images in the exhibition is the total eclipse of the sun.
Okay, yeah, that's what I was going to ask about, because, you know, one of the images, so I want you to walk through that whole thing, but one of the first images that I saw, and it was from your website, was what looks like an eclipse. And I wasn't sure
that was part of the pendulum or what was happening there. So yeah, so
spot on.
So this is the show that's opening up in the fourth. So yeah, walk us through the three sections of it.
So First Light has these three, you would say it's like a triptych. They're three parts of the one thing, the one conceptual overarching theme. And the first begins with, and it's called Under an Ephemeral Sun, which could mean any sun. So this is the only instance where I've used a lowercase s, just to be a little bit pedantic. But this is speaking about the fact that things are in a passage, you know, that there's a duration to time. And it's you can fix points in time, but they're not. I mean, this is a threading between light and time. So this, the inspiration, the work of Foucault that I took as the kind of point of inspiration is a photograph. In fact, he made in it's what they say is the first photograph of the sun, and it was made in collaboration with Hippolyte Fizeau, who was also a physicist at the time, who we split with shortly after, in fact, making this photograph. And it's a daguerreotype, so if I can say a few words about that, they're basically created in, as a unique image on the surface of a, I think at this stage it was silvered, the plate. It was right at the beginning of the invention of the daguerreotype process, so it was 1844, 5 years after the invention. And this image, this particular plaque or plate, so there's only one of them, is held in the collection of the Musée des Arts Climatiques. And the major thing about it, the most significant issue, let's say, is that it's certain that it, of course, will eventually disappear, but that the image will, in fact, degrade much more quickly, rapidly, if it's exposed. And the theories differ here, but to light, but particularly to temperature changes. So there's an absolute embargo on exhibiting this work ever again. Which for me, at first I went, oh, are you serious? I can't put it in the show?
Wow.
But then a second later I thought, oh, no, but that's just fantastic, because in fact that tells us, well, what do we do when we lose something, when something is gone, when it's vanished from our world, as they do, as all things will. And so we have to somehow embrace that or investigate it. For me, that became a thematic, a pivot in the exhibition, or one of the first. So taking it as the ephemeral sun, it's also the ephemeral object, and measures being ephemeral. So you can see how it kind of then flows through the exhibition. So the second, in that actual suite of works, the first piece is a large painting that I made, which is 1 by 2 meters. And it's because there's no walls in a church, as you would know. Well, there are walls, but I'm not allowed to touch them. So I've constructed these kind of individual, either kind of specially lit cases, or in this case, a large kind of triangular pyramid for the work, which is on perspex or plexiglass. I'm not sure what you call it in the US. And it's rear illuminated, so it's made with photoluminescent pigment, which is charged over a few seconds by a UV light, a black light, and so it soaks up all the photons and then discharges them quite beautifully. So it's an image of that first daguerreotype, which can't be exhibited. And the second part of that sequence is a series of daguerreotypes that I worked on in collaboration with a paleoclimatologist whose hobby is to make daguerreotypes. And we went back to the Observatoire de Paris to use one of the original telescopes to make these daguerreotypes of the sun, which was quite challenging, I have to say. So there's a series of daguerreotypes. They're exquisite to look at. They really are between surface and depth, and they sort of float, the images there, because physically it's not just a print on a flat surface. They're contained within the grains of the chemical grains on the plate, so they're quite a thing. And then there's a book which contains, and this is to debunk the whole idea of an origin to begin with, which contains a reproduction of a daguerreotype taken in 1839 of a partial eclipse. And this daguerreotype disappeared in the late 1800s. The Observatoire still look for it, with some hope it will be found again. But So I actually managed to purchase a copy of this book, which has a reproduction of this particular image, which predates the so-called first daguerreotype of the sun, which if you were to be more, you know, precise, you'd say it's the oldest surviving daguerreotype of the sun. But we don't know. As a friend pointed out, Martians could have taken a picture of the sun at any time. We don't know.
That's true.
Well, thanks very much for that. That really helps make my exhibition, you know, concrete. But so the second part of the exhibition, I'll move quickly, is then leaps from this disappeared, eclipsed historical image of an eclipse, and on a screen right in the apse, you know, the bottom of the église, so you step down, and because this is sort of round the pendulum, this first part, which if you can imagine is in the kind of, I forget English, cupola, it's the, I've forgotten the word, you know, the big dome in the middle where you have the congregation normally, and so behind that where the priest would stand is the apse, and this is where the screen projecting, showing a large, large-scale video of the recent total eclipse in the Faroe Islands, where I went on the 20th of March to attempt to film the total solar eclipse, which, you know, the weather there is never good at the best of times. So, okay. And I met all these eclipse chasers and all these, you know, astrophysicists, and I ended up going there with an astrophysicist from the Institute of Astrophysics of Paris with all his gear. And so that was an adventure. And I met lots of local people and ended up making this film in collaboration with a community in Faroe Islands and a local music composer. So it's then subtitled with a narrative text based on a piece that Léon Foucault wrote in 1860 after observing a total eclipse of the sun in Spain. And then following that, there's Foucault's, the next hinging piece of Foucault is a telescope that he, it's his second telescope or second pro, well, it's his second prototype reflecting telescope. So it has, it's the first or second mirrored, so the mirror inside is the main part of the telescope, and he invented this particular way to not only silver the mirror, but to make a parabolic, perfect parabolic curve. So this original object is going to, is being loaned from the Observatory of Paris, and kind of points to the eclipse film. So in a way, Foucault is speaking back to his telescope, which was taken to Spain in 1860 as well. And then the third part, you can interrupt
me.
Yes, talking.
That's okay. No, I like the third part.
And so that part is called Eclipse, sorry, French accent, Eclipse Diaphane. It's a strange title because something, an object, can be diaphanous, but I gave it, I wanted to make, you know, use it in the terms of a noun. So there's an object out there that's the diaphane, in a sense, which is on the perimeter of the eclipse, so on these kind of boundary states between concrete reality and something you experience outside of the normal, which is certainly for a total eclipse, what everyone says. It's out of this world, you know. Suddenly you're seeing light, the corona of the sun, impossible to see. You never see it otherwise in, outside of a total eclipse. You see stars in the daytime that you can't see because the sun is too bright, usually. And so there's all these kind of phenomena that are exposed thanks to not seeing the sun. So in a sense, I kind of take a turn on the idea of, you know, the loss, say, for example, of the first daguerreotype, to somehow then realizing, well, in fact, when something is completely overlooked, erased, forgotten, we can reprise it as an opportunity to go in and re-encounter, remember, or come up with something entirely new and understand, you know, say, the universe or a particular subject more deeply. So that's the kind of philosophical underpinning of that second part. And so the third part is, sorry, it's a big exhibition, is called Beyond the Speed of Light, and this is easier to explain. And this is based on Léon Foucault's 1862 measure, so it was the first precise laboratory measure of the speed of light. And the Musée de l'Art Métier has a vitrine with some of the instruments on display.
You said that was the speed of light?
Speed of light. Speed of light.
Which, what is that? What is that? What does that mean? Or maybe you're about to explain it.
The speed of light. Well, it's the precise figure is not in my head, but it's about 300,000 kilometers per second. Very fast. You can go around the world three times in a second if you were to travel at the speed of light. Does that give you a picture?
Oh, the speed of light. I'm sorry. I thought you were saying the speed of life.
No, the speed of light. Light, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the speed of life, you know, and it's a fantasy, and everyone thinks it's sci-fi. You know, one day we'll travel at the speed of light. Well, until we do, we might as well understand a bit better what it actually is.
Right.
Well, I certainly needed to, so, you know, you know, in 1862, what kind of tools did they have? They didn't have a laser. They didn't even have a light. You know, he used the sun. So as his source. And it was very interesting to, you know, then I realized that nobody's, in fact, you can buy a kit to kind of create the experiment, but if you try and recreate it using his tools, nobody can. I mean, how he did it is extraordinary to kind of conceive how precise he had to be. And at the time he was building his biggest ever telescope, invented this thing called the siderostat, which could follow where the sun could be tracked, or any star in the sky with a telescope. So he was busy at this time, but 1862 marks a very important, significant leap from the measure of this entity, the speed of light, which is the fastest thing in the universe, from being something they did by just looking at it. So his kind of former collaborator, Fizeau, had done an experiment where he shot a little light source, a beam of light, it wasn't strong, across Paris, 17 kilometres return, and tracked, you know, across this huge distance, how long that took by this kind of little toothed wheel thing. But then Foucault kind of took it out of nature in a way and invented this spinning mirror. Well, he wasn't the inventor of it because, in fact, it was used in other experiments, but he adapted this to take light and turn it into something he could measure on an angle of differentiation. So light was forced to behave in a certain way, which is really at the origin of optical physics. Today, that's what they do, you know, when people work with photonics or light now, they actually manipulate nature in this incredible way. They make these little traps and they catch the light in these kind of holes and with magnets and cool it down to way below zero, you know, what they call that's kind of the quantum states. So, you know, Foucault wasn't imagining any of this. He didn't even know that light was a constant, which, you know, until Einstein came around, wasn't even a thought in their mind. But there was a need to know how fast it was going, precisely, more precisely than Fizeau had done. And they'd figured out that it wasn't quite right by actually astronomical calculations, tracking eclipses of satellites of Jupiter and through various other means. And they needed to know it in order to have an exact, it was kind of a reciprocal knowledge, you know, understanding or measures of the size of the solar system. So they didn't know the size of the solar system exactly, and they needed to know more precisely the speed of light. And that was the reason they'd commissioned Foucault to do this experiment. So now basically in this particular installation, it comprises two videos, a kind of dual video piece. One I made in collaboration with a group of optical physicists from Heriot Watt University in Edinburgh, Scotland, who work basically with, they've come up with a way of photographing light in flight using super, super rapid cameras, which are synced to a pulsing laser. So it takes 20 billion frames a second.
My God.
Yeah, that's a lot. And it puts them all in the right order as well. So basically from that, once it resequences those images, you get a film. That's complete. And when we use, the one we use plays back in picoseconds.
And you use it, you said 20 billion frames a second.
Yeah, that's a lot. But basically that's how fast light's going. If you're not taking that many frames a second, you're not seeing, this is why you can see for the first time, light in flight. I mean, they've photographed light in flight before, but to then replay it as a film where you can see the pulse. I went to Scotland once, but we reconstructed, you know, using this new technology, the original experiment, you know, the way in which it worked, which is the setup, you would call it in kind of scientific terms. And so that film is also then narrated, in a sense, by in the voice of Foucault, the relationship between his experiment and how this, what now is capable of being done today and what you're actually seeing. And the second video is an artistic fantasy. It's a complete, as a narrative piece, scripted, that I scripted in the voice of Foucault, which tries to enter into his mind at the time he was inventing this experiment, and how he, and it's really going back to the beginning of our conversation on his from where did he get the idea, and what was his creative inspiration. So I had this kind of, I was in Scotland and I was visiting a castle and I saw these owls and I realized, well, there's this fantastic quote by Hegel, William Friedrich Hegel, and where he says that it's only at the dusk that the owl of Minerva takes flight. And he used this in the context of a philosophy of history, or a history of philosophy, to mean that it's only after the kind of end of an era or an epoch that you can actually begin to get insight into it, into a philosophical idea in this instance. And so I thought, well, this is very interesting when you apply it to light itself, because you can't see it in the present. Well, it's always, or is it always in the present? That's kind of another question, because it's going that fast, What are we actually seeing and when? So in a sense, it's always after the, when we see the light from the sun, it's 8 and a bit minutes after it left the sun, and its time is a quotient here because of its speed. So I thought, well, perhaps Foucault, let's kind of weave a story. He was sort of trying to work out how to solve this problem of removing light from nature, and thought, in fact, well, seeing as it's after the fact, the light, the owl has already taken flight, that, I can only measure the light outside of natural physical conditions. So I have to, in a sense, abstract it, interpret it, force it to behave in another way. So this is the kind of, it's called the Owl of Minerva and I. And then that installation finishes with a large case of the real original instruments from the experiment, which belong to the Observatory of Paris. And there you are.
That sounds fantastic. That's a very exciting show. So I'm really glad you walked us through that. It's a lot, but it's obviously you're working with scientists, and there's so much engagement and learning about our world, and it's so nice to see this, how aesthetics as well as all these scientists and relationships work together. Lastly, this is such an experimental process and such a research-oriented process. Is this work in the market? I mean, do you expect some of it to be sold, or how does the work travel in that way?
Yeah, my gallerist here in Paris is often raises their eyebrow, raises one brow when they see me making art, because they go, oh, what are you going to do with that afterwards, Lily? So, so much of this exhibition, I made this exhibition in the way that it needs to be made, without considering how to sell it, or so in a sense, probably very little is going to be sold. I don't even know. I haven't given it any thought. So some of it's collaborative, so then in a case, it's not even mine to sell. So I don't know what the market is around contemporary art in this case, because, in a sense, the ideas are kind of, also there's a birth of ideas. And for me, it's ownership over things is, everyone wants, of course, to have and has a right to their own copyright. However, I've over the years become more interested in how I can share what I have been given than how I can lock it down to possess it. So,
At the gallery in Paris, I know you're in Paris now, but also at the gallery there, what are you selling at the gallery?
Oh, yeah, so just next door, it's called the Galerie du Rousson. It's a little, nice, lovely little gallery, and I've worked with this Jeanne Lepine and Anne Bringoux for 5 years. Actually, it's Bougois. She changed her name. And 5 years. And so I'll be holding a parallel exhibition in the same, beginning of the same week in that gallery. And so there, I have a film-based work being shown there. But that, you know, you can sell film, you can sell video. It's just rare. So it's not as easy as a drawing or a print or a painting. But in that exhibition, I'm also made a, it's called Better Per Se. And it's, when I say parallel, it's kind of runs alongside in terms of how we think about history. But the theme is on the overlooked history of female astronomers at the Observatory of Paris. And I worked in collaboration with a woman who's an emeritus astronomer at the observatory, who has, we say, maybe 87 years. Don't know. But is still there working every day. And so she worked with me over 2 years to do this research and to make a film. And there's a sequence of work on optical mirrors, which you know, you use some of these in telescopes and various other devices, taking fragments from the last very few photographs surviving of the of women who have worked in the in positions of as astronomers and or mathematicians, which is mainly what women, the post women, have held in the observatoire. So I've taken these sort of fragments to make these mirrors, kind of very light, kind of almost traces on the mirrors of these images. So that's, you know, a second exhibition. That,
well,
if you're in Paris,
that,
you can just wander down the street and see at the same time.
And so, and but that exhibition at the gallery, obviously, those things are for sale as opposed to the
yeah.
other show.
Well, I mean, the things in the museum are for sale. It's just that you don't see a label or a price on it. You know, you have to ask the gallerists. So, I mean,
right.
I don't know. Eventually, they might try. They'll probably try and sell them for me because I don't have anywhere to put. There's really only this painting is the one thing that I would sell. But yeah, I mean, it's not. It's something after all these years. You know, I had an opportunity gathering in years. So at the beginning of my career, I had a commercial gallery and I was selling everything, and I started to become known for some certain. You know, everyone wanted this particular kind of work. And at this point, I thought, no way. And that's not why I make art. I make art to create new things, not to repeat it. So
what was the
actually,
particular kind of work everyone wanted?
Well, the irony is that I actually embargoed. I put a kind of ban on making this particular kind of work for 15 years, deliberately, because of this problem. And I quit that gallery, which was kind of a bit reactionary, a bit kind of over the top. I was so frightened of getting stuck, you know, having to repeat the same things the rest of my life. And funnily enough, it's this photoluminescent paint, and I love it, but I just, at the time, it was a bit becoming a gimmick, because I'd done two shows using this particular technique, and it's beautiful, so at the time,
You said photoluminescent paint.
It's photoluminescent pigment, you know, like glow-in-the-dark.
Right.
You get on these stars that you can stick on the ceiling in kiddies' bedrooms.
Right.
Or horror, you know, masks, Halloween. That sort of thing, but you can buy it in a pigment, and it's very strong now. And I mix it up with glue and incorporate it into these paintings, so that you get actually, you don't have to use specialist lighting. You can just switch on a light or daylight, and then put it in the dark, and it glows. So you can do some really wonderful things. But between 2005 and now, I haven't used it, which is a few years.
Well, that's nice. That brings us full circle. I'm really excited about your show. It sounds very beautiful. Congratulations on that. And,
thank you.
Thank you so much for talking with me today. I really appreciate it.
I really appreciate it. But thank you very much.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.